This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Storm sweep across the mid-Atlantic with tornado watches posted from Virginia into the Philadelphia area. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson.
The big threat, though, is probably going to be damaging wind. What that means is, yes, we could have some tornadoes, but a lot of it is going to be straight-line winds with gusts potentially 70, 80 miles an hour in spots.
The severe weather is affecting air travel. Kathleen Bangs is with FlightAware, which reports over 7,600 delays within, into, or out of the U.S. today and more than 1,500 total cancellations.
They're sleeping at the airport. They're trying to find a way out because the issue is going to be for them. Most of those flights tomorrow will be canceled also.
A large number of people at a Montana military base say they have cancer. CBS's Matt Piper reports.
A new cleanup effort has been ordered after the Air Force says it's detected unsafe levels of a likely cancer carcinogen at underground launch control centers at a nuclear missile base in Montana. The discovery is part of the military's ongoing investigation after a briefing showed at least 9 current or former missileers at the Maelstrom base were diagnosed with the rare blood cancer non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Now a grassroots group says at least 268 troops who served 3 nuclear missile sites have self-reported being diagnosed with cancer.
The fight is on to limit what can be talked about in public when it comes to evidence in former President Trump's January 6th case. CBS's Robert Costa.
In a filing, Trump's lawyers push back against prosecutors and their request to limit what the former president can say, arguing it is, in effect, asking the court to censor his political speech. The request from federal prosecutors came as Trump's attacks against special counsel Jack Smith are now standard on the campaign trail.
He's a deranged human being. Those indictments aren't worth the paper they're written on.
His social media outbursts, including writing, "If you go after me, I'm coming after you," prompted prosecutors to act, alarmed about the possibility that Trump could divulge sensitive information or even evidence in the case.
An investigation is underway in Southern California after 2 helicopters collided while responding to a brush fire yesterday, killing 3 people. CBS's Mark Strassman reports.
Killed aboard the observation helicopter, contract pilot Tony Sousa and 2 Cal Fire veterans, 44-year-old Captain Tim Rodriguez and 46-year-old Assistant Chief Josh Bischoff, here on Facebook, ironically talking about aircraft separation.
We're responsible for maintaining separation between the fixed-wing air tankers and also the rotary helicopters.
Why these 2 helicopters flew close enough to collide will be a focus of this investigation.
This is CBS News.
Hire with minimal effort and max speed with Indeed. Their hiring solution platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For WCFW and the Tap FM, I'm Jimmy Cuska. Here's what you need to know in the Chippewa Valley. This morning, hearings begin as a Chippewa County judge will decide whether the lone suspect in last year's murder of 10-year-old Lily Peters will be tried as an adult or if the case will be moved to juvenile court. A 15-year-old boy is charged with homicide, which carries a mandatory life sentence if he's convicted, as well as 2 counts of sexual assault. Judge Stephen Gibbs ruled last month that autopsy photos and videos would be sealed, but did not decide whether prosecutors would be limited only to information in the criminal complaint filed with the charges. Peters was found dead in the woods near her home on April 25, 2022. Hearings are scheduled to go into next week in the case. The bodies of 2 people were recovered in Barron County by officials after a man's body was seen in the water near a running pontoon Friday afternoon in Pekegama Lake near Chetek. The sheriff's office said the bodies of 59-year-old Scott Brumman of Chippewa Falls and 59-year-old Doug Robinson of Chetek were found about 5 hours apart. The Wisconsin DNR is investigating. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Cuska.
She's the newest of 7 elected Wisconsin Supreme Court justices. Janet Protasiewicz begins her 10-year term in August when she is sworn in. It's a long-time tradition which includes use of the court's seal created in 1848. But did you know it features the scales of justice, but not carried by a blindfolded Greek goddess? Instead, a hand holds the scales, representing justice is in human hands. It also means everything is official once the seal is stamped on any court documents. For Civic Media, I'm Terry Barr.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
I would be remiss if I didn't say that some of what we do in government always is political. It has policy impacts. It has political impacts. But if your raison d'etre and your organizing principle is that my guy wins and your guy loses, the entire country suffers. That is not our call to serve. That is not what we raise our hand and say an oath.
The Maggie Dawn Show, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. on your local civic media radio station and on the Civic Media app. It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Kreutz. Weekdays from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and website formerly known as Twitter at Green News Report.
Are you tired of think tank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the AFL-CIO just released their executive pay watch report, which they do every year. And again, it's one of these things that tells us just how bad working people in this country are getting screwed over. Used to be when my grandparents, and I talk about this all the time, when my grandparents' generation ruled the roost and they were in the middle of their working lives, the CEO to worker pay was somewhere 20 to 30 to 1. We're well beyond that. And here to tell us who the highest paid CEOs, who are greedy folks at the top are, as Brendan Reese to come talk with us. Brendan is the Deputy Director of Corporations and Capital Markets for the AFL-CIO. You can check out their website on this report at paywatch.org. Brendan, thanks for taking time for us.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having me on your show.
So just how bad is this report? Every year I see this 200, 300, 400 times what the average worker makes. How bad is it this year?
Yeah. So in 2022, CEOs of S&P 500 index companies received on average $16.7 million in total compensation. And that's a $5 million increase over the past 10 years. On average, a $500,000 pay increase each year. I mean, that's almost an impossible amount of money to imagine. In contrast, real hourly wages, as measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, fell 1.6% after inflation. The average S&P 500 CEO made 272 times what their median employee made. So it would take an employee of one of those companies over six lifetimes to earn what their CEO earned just last year.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible to me. And I was looking at some of the numbers and, you know, some of the numbers that grabbed my attention, because I always like to find a favorite. You know, like I have a favorite billionaire, Stephen Schatz Biscotti made his money the old fashioned way, outsourcing jobs. But in this one, Live Nation CEO, Michael Rapino, he's now my favorite, $139 million. This guy made in 2022, according to your report, you know, charging me excess fees on tickets. So every time I go to take my kids to a concert and the price of the ticket's $50 and I got to pay $40 in fees, I know that I'm helping Michael Rapino. Maybe we can get him to $140 million next year.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Live Nation Entertainment had the highest CEO to worker pay ratio in the S&P 500 last year at over 5,000 to 1. Live Nation Entertainment also, you know, they're the ones who brought us dynamic pricing algorithms for the purchasing of concert tickets and sporting events tickets, and using AI to extract every last bit of value from our pocketbooks. So, you know, these CEO to worker pay ratios, they matter because they're contributing to economic inequality, right? And an imbalance in our economy. When workers see that the CEO is receiving the lion's share of compensation, it sends a negative message to the rest of the workforce. And in contrast, companies with low pay ratios, those are the companies that are more likely to be investing in their employees and creating good paying jobs. So our PayWatch website, it features a database of CEO pay for all publicly traded companies, as well as the company's specific pay ratios when they're disclosed. We also have a map that you can look up how CEOs whose companies are headquartered in your state, how much they made compared to the average worker in your state. And so this information is really important for people to understand the role of CEO pay in fueling economic inequality and imbalancing our economy, right? We have a choice. We can choose between an economy where companies, you know, grow jobs and invest in their workforce, or a winner-take-all system in which CEOs are reaping all the rewards and the rest of us are asked to do more with less, as has been the case over the past several decades. As you rightly pointed out at the beginning of this interview, that, you know, historically, pay ratios between CEOs and the rest of the workforce were not outrageous at 200-300 times average worker pay. You know, after World War II, going up to about the 1980s, the average ratios were 20, 30, topping out at 40 times back in the early 1980s. And now we're well higher of that with the type of pay increases that we've been seeing really accruing to the CEO class in the past several decades.
Well, I would argue that and you can correct me if you think you're wrong, if I'm wrong, and I don't think you will, but I would argue that, you know, when my grandparents were in the workforce, you think the 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, union density was like 35% in this country. You couldn't trip over a worker without finding a union member. Today, with that number in the private sector being, what, 6.5, under 7, you know, CEOs feel kind of emboldened that they don't worry about having to deal with organized workers because there aren't as many of us as there were back when my grandparents were fighting this stuff.
That's right. You know, working people, we need to have the freedom to negotiate for, you know, fair wages and benefits, and CEOs are not just going to give it to us, even when that might be in the best interest of the company over the long term, right? Investing in your workforce, having a productive and motivated employee base is critical to the long-term success of companies. But CEOs are not in it for the long term. They're looking at quarter-to-quarter stock price performance. They're looking about how they can cut corners now to boost their pay. And even if that comes to the detriment of our economy as a whole, by making working people's jobs less secure and more more demanding and stressful, including through the use of AI technology.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Brendan Reese. He's the Deputy Director of Corporations and Capital Markets for the AFL-CIO. You can check out their website on this Executive PayWatch report over at paywatch.org. We'll get links over on social media. I can take a look at that. This year, I noticed there's a caveat, and you've got AI-fueled CEO pay. CEOs are rushing to incorporate artificial intelligence into their business. So as bad as this is now, and it's bad, I think the response here is it's going to get worse, and it's going to get a lot worse, and I fear more quickly than most working people understand.
Absolutely. So we looked at the highest paid CEOs from last year, the $100 million CEOs who topped the ranking. And they are all rushing to incorporate artificial intelligence into their businesses. And right now we have we face a choice in how this new technology is going to be used. You know, artificial intelligence has the power to make us more productive in our jobs, but it can be also used in ways that undermine the quality of our jobs and even eliminate them altogether. You know, in some industries, artificial intelligence is already making HR decisions about hiring, scheduling, the assignment of tasks, performance reviews, and even terminations are being handled by artificial intelligence. You know, we as working people must have a voice in how this new technology is being deployed into the workplace. And the best way to do that is through a union. And that's exactly what's going on right now with the strike in Hollywood. by performers and writers. They're striking against the major television and motion picture producers over how artificial intelligence will be used in their industry today. Performers are worried about the use of what's called deepfake generative AI technology to create entirely synthetic performances. Imagine actors being forced as a condition to work to sign away their rights to their own image so that AI can recreate their performances without compensating those actors in the future.
Or taking away any intellectual property whatsoever, thus making AI perfectly legal to be used in the public space as well. Which, again, as I've been saying about these strikes, this is the front war. This is the front line of the class war. This is the front line of this AI war. Because, you know, if they lose this, it will filter down to everyone else. And me, as someone who, you know, I've been a truck driver for 30 years. I know that we're on the chopping block as well. As soon as automation comes online, you can kiss millions of jobs goodbye because they will be replaced with machines that will never stop. And this is one of those things I keep telling my non-union trucking buddies. Hey, this is the reason you organize into a union, because that ABF contract that was just signed, there's language in there that says no automation for the next 5 years. You got to be able to sit down and negotiate this stuff, which is why people should be signing contracts and joining and forming unions quickly.
That's right. The fight that the entertainment industry workers are having right now, that's our fight. It's about keeping the humanity in our jobs and making sure that we have a voice in how these new technologies are being used. And you're absolutely right. It's not just entertainment industry workers. It's not just white collar workers. And we're seeing artificial intelligence being used at fast food drive-ins to take orders. We're seeing artificial intelligence used in Amazon warehouses to assign tasks and to structure the pace of work through digital management of the workforce in ways that are increasing stress for people who still have their jobs, but are now reporting to an algorithm versus a human being.
No, we're in scary times. And here's my problem with this, Brandon. Look, you're a DC guy. I know the AFL is working on all this stuff, and maybe there's something I'm not seeing, but I'm not seeing a legislative path to helping in any of this. I'm not seeing our government anywhere near. Look, I've been calling for people to get ahead of this for years. I've been calling for a technology tax for 10 years now to slow down the rate of automation, the rate of AI taking over jobs. I've been saying this for the last decade. Hey, we need to get out of this. If nothing, at least on the tax front, to make people whole. Is there anything that you can point to that's going on in D.C. where, you know, there maybe someone's working on this to say, hey, maybe we need to slow this down, take a minute, take a breath?
Yeah, so President Biden and the White House have issued an AI Bill of Rights to try to flesh out what type of protections we need with this powerful new technology to ensure that it benefits all working people and is not used to enrich corporate CEOs. And so we've the AFL-CIO and other unions participate in that effort. But, you know, the best protection for working people is their union. And we need to have a voice in how this new technology is being used. And the best way to do that is through the freedom to organize and negotiate over how this new technology will be used. And so, in my book, the best way is to empower working people to be able to form unions. That's passage, of course, of the Protecting the Right to Organize or PRO Act. And certainly we have a lot that needs to be done. We have to remember, Washington will always be catching up to developments, right? And it's up to us as working people to come together through our unions to be able to push back on the use of artificial intelligence in ways that destroys jobs and increases economic inequality and enriches CEOs.
The report, the Executive Pay Watch report by the AFL-CIO, you can find that at paywatch.org. Last question on this. Anything positive? What do we take from this? What do you want people to know? What do you want folks to get from this message?
So, I would say that the most important thing is that how AI is used is a choice. And working people have the power to change the rules of the game to ensure that technology is used in a way that's fair and enriches our society and economy as a whole, and does not lead to incredible growth and wealth disparities, right? And I take inspiration from the SAG-AFTRA and Writers Guild strike, that this is over 100,000 workers who've said, no, enough's enough. We need to have protections in how this new technology is being used. We need to have a voice in how it's being used. We're not opposed to artificial intelligence. We recognize that it has the power to make our jobs easier, to make workers more productive, to raise standards of living. But if we don't have a voice in how that technology is used, it'll just accrue to the CEOs. Yep. And on our PayWatch website, we profile the CEO pay of the companies that are make up the television and movie production companies. They make on average $35 million a year, including folks like Disney's Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, whose his employment contract now offers him $30 million a year. Just this summer, right before the performers went on strike, he said their demands were not realistic. Well, I got news for Bob Iger. His demands of his employees, they're not realistic. We're not going to defer to CEOs to implement artificial intelligence in ways that undermine our jobs and undermine the broad-based prosperity that this country was founded on.
There you go. No, I'm right there with you. Brendan, I appreciate you taking time. Great report. Hope folks will take a look at it. You can find it at paywatch.org, the Executive Paywatch Report by the AFL-CIO. Brendan Reese, appreciate the time, man.
Thank you, Rick.
Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
As I said, that Live Nation CEO, $139 million. And that money, honestly, it comes from you. It comes from you in the form of higher ticket prices. Every time you go to buy, and you don't have a choice anymore. This is the thing. The right loves to talk. Oh, choice. You got choice. No, you don't. You're going to go Live Nation or Ticketmaster. And then there are a bunch of other ones that kind of, feed off of that. But it's the same thing. At the end of the day, you're getting ripped off and lining someone like his pockets. It's angering. And just, this is what Biden's talking about, junk fees and all that. Here's a guy who's making a living off junk fees. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you, man?
Fine, thank you. And I think this is an important topic. On the one hand, we're living in a century where modern human beings, especially in the Western world, have got a lot of time in terms of doing something that they want, leisure time, and especially with regard to how they spend their entertainment dollar. Something that was unheard of 500, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. This, that a huge part of the economy, if you would have told somebody a couple of hundred years ago, would be dedicated exclusively to entertaining people. They would have thought, you're crazy. How is that possible? But that's the reality of modern life in the Western world. And now this idea that, well, we can do this without paying anybody because, with artificial intelligence taken to its logical ends, you could create artificial entities that look like human beings playing characters. You can write scripts. You can do all of these things. And, you know, in the same way that reality TV, and for people who don't know it, the reason that you have reality TV today is because in the late 1980s, there was a strike, and the networks needed to figure out a way to sort of fill that time. And all, they decided, well, hey, let's create, you know, the reality television. And the same thing, and then that got accelerated 20 years later when there was another strike, and reality TV really took off. And, you know, you don't have to pay them. You know, the cast of Friends, at the height of that show's success, that they were paying $20 million an episode just to the six major characters in order to put them on the screen per episode. Now, for a reality TV show, you advertise for that. You don't have to pay people anything. They will claw each other's hair out to be one of the people who stars on a reality TV show.
Yeah, so, just watch one of those reality shows. You're spot on.
Yeah, I mean, it's garbage, but people love it for some reason. And so this is a way to circumvent that. You can actually give people dramas and comedies without screenwriters, without directors, without actual actors in the extreme, you know, moving forward. But and there's this theory within economics, the creative destruction, that, you know, that you do destroy things as society progresses and technology advances. But out of that comes something better because you create. So, and the argument that people like to use is, okay, we're not looking to, resurrect the horse and buggy industry because we moved on into automobiles. That's a good point. But at the same time, we need to recognize that when technology is developed, it's not developed by these entities that are most likely to profit from them exclusively. A lot of this was developed using public dollars, universities, other places, and the idea that then it's going to be usurped, co-opted by the small group of corporate interests and people who will then capitalize upon it to the exclusion of everybody else is what we want to check. I'm not arguing against AI. I'm arguing against its misuse, in which it helps to concentrate resources and wealth and power in the hands of a few people. I think we can utilize it productively in terms of entertainment, but let's just be fair and sort of distribute its benefits among people. Let's simply say, all right, well, there's going to be a handful of people who are going to be making all of the money, and the rest of us are going to be paying them to enjoy the entertainment that they produce, not thinking for a moment that who would they put out of work.
No, you're spot on. And look, I'm not a Luddite yet. I don't say smash the machine. Like you, I think we need to distribute the profits from it. But you think about it, every major technological advancement for the past, a handful of people did really, really well, and all of the working people got screwed and took it on the chin. And my point is, right, this should be that one time where maybe we don't.
Right. I mean, you and I both know that in the last 40 years, we doubled productivity in this country, and then we doubled it again. But is the average American living 3 and 4 times as well? No, because what we did was we simply made sure that the people at the top got the benefits of that increase in productivity. Average Americans are working longer, and for most of them, they've lost ground. You have to work harder and longer, take fewer vacations, have less time with your children, less time off, and Americans don't even take their full allotment of vacations and days off because they're afraid they're going to miss out. Because God forbid that they should miss out at a day at work,
yeah,
because something can happen that might cost them an advancement down the road. And that's a shame. And then we need to start addressing this disparity. When a society moves forward because of the advances that we make technologically and otherwise, well, again, I'm not a socialist. I'm for people being able to become billionaires. But you know what? As we move up that scale in terms of profit, you get to pay more, just like we did in the 1950s when we actually said that up to 92% we're going to pay if you make huge sums of money. And that was supposedly the golden age of the American economy.
Yeah. No, the point of the 92% tax rate, and this is where my mind is I don't think anyone's worth $1 billion. Sorry. I just don't. But I get your point. Real quick, I got about 45 seconds. How do you think you get that message out to average everyday working people? Because individually, when I have conversations with people, they get what you just said, all of that. But in groups, not so much. How do you think that gets out then?
Well, honestly, it's because of this sort of misbegotten narrative that it continues to permeate America and American history in the way in which we perceive wealth. You know, we tend to think of people who make a great deal of money as some usually lone guy who went out there and created the better mousetrap and then became a billionaire, be it Bill Gates or Warren Buffett or Elon Musk or whatnot, Jeff Bezos. We need to get across to people, young people and adults, that none of that was possible without the infrastructure, without the educational institutions, without the regulatory system in America that makes this a great place to do business. Yep. And ensures those people can make all that money. So guess what? They didn't do it on their own, unlike the narrative that you've been taught.
Yeah.
So let's ask them to pay a little bit more, given they're benefiting from the things there the taxpayers go.
Appreciate it, Steve.
In order to get
Thanks, buddy. Quick break. Right back.
This is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1890. That was the day that one of the heroines of the U.S. labor movement, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, was born in Concord, New Hampshire. Elizabeth learned her progressive politics at a young age. Her father was a socialist and her mother a feminist. Elizabeth was kicked out of high school for speaking out in favor of socialism. This did not slow her down. She kept speaking and her reputation grew. She became a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. She traveled the country organizing and speaking to workers. From the Minnesota Iron Range to the textile mills of Lawrence, Massachusetts, Elizabeth was on the front lines of the labor struggle. She was arrested for her activity 10 times, but was never sentenced. During World War I, Flynn was arrested and stood trial for speaking out against the war. The experience led her to become one of the founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, an organization dedicated to protecting freedom of speech. In the 1930s, Flynn became a member of the U.S. Communist Party, writing a regular column for the Daily Worker. But despite her personal political ideas, she supported Democratic Party President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1944. During the 1950s, she was caught up in the anti-communist hysteria led by Senator Joe McCarthy. She went to prison for 2 years for allegedly violating the Smith Act, a law against overthrowing the government. She died while on a visit to Russia in 1964. More than 20,000 people attended her funeral there. A monument to Flynn stands at the Forest Home Cemetery just outside of Chicago, where she is buried alongside the graves of Eugene Dennis, Big Bill Haywood, and the Haymarket Martyrs. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
How about a little bit of good news for a change? Specifically, good news about news. The demise of local newspapers has been a very depressing story in the last few years, with several thousand of them gobbled up by Wall Street profiteers. Those money powers loot the publication's assets, then callously shut down each community's paper or reduces them to empty news shelves. So, that's that. Local print journalism is passé, right? Wrong. High-spirited, community-minded subscribers in places like Glen Rose, Texas, Hamburg, Iowa, Portland, Maine, and International Falls, Minnesota, are humming an upbeat tune of regeneration that could be titled, Not Dead Yet. In Maine, for example, 5 of the state's 6 daily papers and 17 weeklies were sinking under the ownership of an investment group, but all were recently bought by the National Trust for Local News, a nonprofit started 2 years ago. The trust is turning each publication over to local nonprofit owners and helping them find ways to become sustainable. Another new effort called Cherry Road Media has bought 77 rural papers in 17 states, most from the predatory Gannett conglomerate that wanted to dump them. Cherry Road's business plan is simple, old-time genius. Return editorial decision-making to local people and journalists who know the town. Be an active presence and participant in community affairs. Make the locals responsible for sustaining their town's paper and, most important, reinvest profits in real local journalism that advances democracy. This is Jim Hightower saying, in both of these new initiatives, the foremost mission is to serve the common good of the communities, not to pad the wealth of a few distant financiers. To learn more about these models and how you might implement something similar in your town, contact Institute for Rural Journalism, ruraljournalism.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, no, we don't need the Voting Rights Act. No, don't need any of that. Because, you know, those states that you would in the past would have had to get pre-clearance, they've learned. They would never do anything like make 161 voting precinct changes since November of 2022. No, they would never do that. Except in Mississippi, where they did just that. And evidently leaving, you know, fewer precincts statewide and moving dozens of them, just shuffling stuff around. You know, no big deal. Now, I look at Ohio. My former home state. Evidently, the election officials there doing some shuffling around in Cuyahoga and Summit counties. Cuyahoga is where I lived in Cleveland. And when I saw this, I didn't have to read the article to know exactly where they moved the voting precincts. You know, most of them on the east side, you know, where all the poor working class black people live. Yeah. Never. But hey, nothing to see. Move along. Now, they did move a couple in others in suburban areas. But the mass of the people affected gonna be on the east side. But Tuesday, big election in Ohio, and here to share some thoughts on that debacle, I've asked our good friend Bob Ney to come talk with us. Bob's a former Ohio congressman and political analyst. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So, any shock that they're moving precincts around in the Cleveland area?
No, because my friend, the late Senator Pat Sweeney, he used to say years ago that, you know, the election's not over with till St. Mary's reports. And St. Mary's was the cemetery, he used to joke. So,
okay.
Yeah. But in Cuyahoga, it's always a rough and tumble county, as you know. And it's a county that there are so many high stakes for votes. And, of course, what they've done, there's more than 47,000 voters being affected by those changes to 50 voting precincts in Cleveland, I think East Cleveland, Seven Hills, Shaker Heights, South Euclid, et cetera. And a lot of the polling places, I think, are in schools, aren't they, Rick?
Yeah.
Most of them. And they're saying that the changes were the result of consolidation, is what the Secretary of State.
Yeah, of course. You do that 5 days before an election.
Well, here's the other thing. You know, if it is because of consolidation, there are other buildings, churches that are down the street from the schools that will gladly let their facilities be used. So if there were consolidations in those, you know, eight or nine burgs there of Cleveland, you know, why would you not then say, okay, well, we're going to go down the block from the school that used to be there. It's not there anymore due to consolidation. We'll go down the block to the church, you know, one block away.
Yeah, but 5 days, Bob? 5 days?
I mean, they didn't do that. They're just moving them where they want. I mean, they don't even make a rational argument by saying, well, consolidation caused this to uproot 47,000 voters. You know, it's consolidation of schools. And yes, they do it within 5 days of of the whole process going down. I mean, it's just absolutely bizarre. Of course, I think they're going to get their lunch handed to them on issue one. I really do.
I hope so.
What's that?
I really hope so. I mean, I'm at the point where, you know, the voters of Ohio have got to see what's going on, as you know, and maybe you'll agree or disagree with me. I look at what Republicans are doing in that state as, you know, potentially, you know, the last throes of power, and going, we're just going to consolidate so much that there's no way we can be held accountable down the road. Because honestly, I mean, they've done, you know, we had a representative from Iowa recently, just in the last hour, talking about what, you know, what's happening and all the horrible policies that are going on there. And Ohio's Iowa on steroids at this moment. The voters at some point have got to revolt when lives don't get better, don't you think? And there's part of me that goes, this is their attempt to insulate themselves from being held accountable down the road.
Right. I mean, Tom Suttis, who was of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, I've known Tom forever and a day, just did a very interesting editorial today which is right along the lines of what you just said. And Tom's always been, you know, a straight shooter on Ohio, but he, you know, he exactly mimics what you said, because here's the thing, you know, back in 1985, we went in the state Senate from 1716 Democrat. It was a Democrat controlled state. Dick Celeste, governor. We went from 1716 in Democrat control of the Ohio Senate, and I ran that year, and we flipped to 1815, right? With the change in the state government, though, you know, there was a working relationship. You had Vern Reif was Speaker in the House, Democrat-controlled. You had Dick Celeste as governor. You know, long later after that came Voinovich, you know, from Cleveland. And the bottom line to all this is that it remained a pretty decent give-and-take state, pretty decent, you know, in a sense of making things work, right? And then along came, of course, Kasich et al., and then the state Senate, I mean, went from 1815 to unrecognizable, you know, with a small amount of Democrats, and then the House. And then this whole power grab madness started, and I think it completely hits a pinnacle, Rick, with issue one, because first of all, the Republicans said that they weren't going to have special elections. What did they just do? Special election.
Yeah.
And then they want to change it. And the people, isn't that funny that the guy from Illinois that just put 4 million in, he's from Illinois, he must really care about the Ohio Constitution, you know? He's from Illinois.
Yeah.
So he cares about Ohio. Maybe he thinks Illinois is going to annex Ohio. And you have this outrageous 60% of the vote, which if you look at the history of Ohio and some major issues of rights to vote, you know, and other issues that have passed, they would never have made it with this. So they're trying to rig the power and then throw in the AE or the First Energy scandal. And I just don't know how long people are going to put up. One party rule without paying attention, you know, to the people can eventually, I assume, go under.
Yeah, I mean, but then again, look, I've been looking at this whole Trump thing, going, at what point do voters walk away from Trump? Because, you know, he did what he's accused of, and he's admitted to doing it. You know, how do you get people to, you know, to completely, you know, walk away from that?
Well, there's the problem for it's the primary, because like I said, I don't care. Yes, if he's convicted of something prior to the Republican National Convention, he's going to lose some votes, small s, some votes. He is still going to have the percentage to win the Republican National Convention. The only thing that stops that is if he decides to not be in the Republican National Convention, because privately he's convinced he can't win. Now, I'm not going to say he can't win the general, because politics is so bizarre these days. You know, you just got to wait till the very end to make a call.
Yeah, no, you hit a recession, all cards, all bets are off.
Yeah, it's off. And you know, yeah, he could have my old bed in Morgantown Federal Corrections running the country. I mean, who knows? So, but you know, as far as Trump himself, if convicted, he will lose some votes, but he still will have the percentage he needs. Now, with all these Republicans in there, it's not a great percentage. You know, it's under 50%, but he still got it.
Yeah, but I look at Ohio again. You know, it comes back down to the gerrymandering. I mean, they got away with, again, you know, using maps that even the Ohio Supreme Court shot down a number of times. It's like no rules apply to them. Wow. And no one holds them. This is my problem with this, that there doesn't seem to be any deference for the rule of law. It's my team, you know, the ends justify the means if my team wins.
Well, look what they did. You know, it used to be with the Supreme Court. I was there. I went through redistricting. You know, I was a state legislator involved in redistricting. And, you know, if we sent something in the court in Ohio, said no to us, guess what? We came back and then punted. What did they do when the court said no to them in Ohio? They sent the same thing back.
Yep.
Literally the same thing. I mean, they didn't even bother to change the dot.
It just, again, it shows that they know that the voters aren't going to hold them accountable. And this is where my fear level is that there is no accountability for an out of control party hell-bent on power and control.
Well, like I said, when it started out, you know, and the Republicans picked up a few seats. I know this can happen with either party. I understand that. But when they picked up a few seats, there was still such a balance, and, you know, things got done. And then just over periods of time, the more seats they got, the more callous it got. But I think this hits the epitome, the peak, I should say, of arrogance that I've, you know, seen in my state in my modern lifetime here.
Yeah, sadly, it seems to be
doing a special election to negate the November vote before it happens.
Isn't that amazing? And why isn't that the top story in our news media? Why haven't we heard more of this?
Well, I've told people that, you know, countless people have asked me, and I said, look, this is about the legislature trying to stop a vote they think is going to happen on the abortion issue in November. That's what this is about. Now, I've told people, if you 100% believe in, right to life's position, or if this was about guns and they were trying to, if you 100% believe in Second Amendment gun issues, you still have to look at the future of the state, and this is not the way to do it, to make a 60%. You know, it's just not the way to do it. It's not good the Senate does this. This is an abomination in the Senate, and it's an abomination here. And you have former, Republican governors, you have former Republican attorney generals that have, thank goodness, come out against this and said, wait a minute, this is not the right thing to do for the state, no matter what you think about the abortion issue. This was designed to stop a November vote. This is exactly what this was.
I would have been surprised that they just say, no, this will only apply for anything that happens in November of 2023. Because, this again is another one of these arguments that I make of why we should be taxing billionaires, why we shouldn't have billionaires. Because you said a moment ago, the huge amount of money came from an out-of-state billionaire. And I would love to see Illinois annex Ohio, because I never liked Indiana anyway. But this, again, this is another one of these things. Who was calling for this? Where is the 50% of people in the state, petitioning for this? Where's that groundswell of support that was, if you're going to talk about participatory democracy, where's that at? From what I understand, it's just a couple of billionaires who've spent a whole bunch of money.
Well, it is, just because of their philosophy. And, again, out-of-state people deciding that the Ohio Constitution isn't crafted well enough. And overall, when you look at how the legislature did this, again, they defied everything. They said they weren't going to do special elections. The people have a vote. And I pointed to the Senate because, the Senate has some idiotic rules, the U.S. Senate I'm talking about. Idiotic rules. Yeah. I mean, the 60%. That's created by the Senate. The one vote. Look what's going on with the Pentagon now. One senator can hold up the entire system. They have to yield to him. They don't dare make anybody angry. These are crafted devices for people that were in power to get certain results. That's the way the U.S. Senate was crafted. That's the way the Ohio legislators crafted this issue coming up here.
Yeah, it's angering, as a voter, and as someone who cares about democracy, it's angering. And I'm hoping on Tuesday, the voters of Ohio go to the polls and show their anger. So the question is, let's say this goes down 60-40. Do the Republicans in the House and Senate in Ohio, do they care?
Well, they're not going to care until it's made an issue, until somebody... you have these people that have these, super PACs. You've got them on the Democratic side. You've got them on the Republican side. Until, people get together and decide, we're going to push these points, and we're going to make the ads necessary to bring these points to the forefront. Otherwise, the issue goes down. The legislators won't like it, but nobody's going to say, look what you guys tried to do, because nobody's going to, you know, do that drumbeat of a message out there. It's all, as you know, it's messaging. That's what it is.
Yeah. So, again, I come back to, how do the Democrats learn from this? Because, you know, I was just reading a report that said, you know, Biden's losing support with Black and Latino working class voters. And I'm going, how? How is that possible? We're lowest unemployment. Wages are going up. Inflation's coming down. We're building factories all across this country. Things economically seem to be pointing in the right direction. Look, there are problems, but, you know, they seem to be going in a good direction. How can you be losing support among groups that are historically now at historic low unemployment numbers? How's that possible?
Black and Latinos. Well, look at this one, Rick. This one blew my mind today. Most Americans in a new poll say they disapprove of President Biden's handling of climate change. And in the new poll, and this is Washington Post, not Fox News, University of Maryland poll, 57% of Americans surveyed said they disapproved of Biden's handling of climate change, while only 27% said they have read or heard anything, basically, a great deal about the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, you know, if this was 75% of the people think that climate, you know, change is nonsense, right? That's not what this polling's saying.
Oh,
this
my
polling's
God.
Saying people that care about the climate are like, well, I don't know what he's done.
Have you ever seen the movie Idiocracy?
Yes.
Man, we're living that.
Yeah. This article today blew my mind. Of all the issues, it just absolutely blew my mind.
I don't know what it is,
for the
but I'm against
campaign.
It.
You know? It's amazing.
Oh, gosh, help me. Oh, this is just, but I guess predictable, right? I mean, this is where we are as a country.
Well,
red hats, maybe, blue hats.
Maybe they just need to, you know, get everything on TikTok. I don't know what works these days, but that polling, again, if this was just a bunch of people saying, oh, you know, this is nonsense, it's not. But they have no idea what's in the bill, or no idea that he's basically even done a bill.
Yeah. So what those 57% is, and you know, now that my mind's wrapping around it, I'm still struggling with the people who don't know anything about it. It's anyone who would vote for Trump, 35%, maybe 40%, and then it's the people on the far extreme of the climate, where we shut everything down, who's saying no, he's not doing enough. He's doing something, but it's not nearly enough. As my mind's going, I can almost see it. To a degree, I think maybe I can put that math together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at real quick here, individual part of the polling. The solar panel tax credits have the support of 65% of everyone polled. All right. Now, only 15% were opposed. The rest of them didn't know, right?
Right.
Electric vehicle tax credits had the support of 50%, with only 22% opposed, and then 26%, they don't know. Even fewer respondents had heard or read about tax credits, or tax credits to buy heat pumps, or on and on and on. And you look at this, and you just wonder, you know, how you get that message out there.
Yeah, no, you do what the right does. You saturate everything. With people, you know, out there, you know, telling the stories. Like, I've been talking about those, about most of that stuff over the last couple of years. At one point or another, I've brought it up. It's quite remarkable where we are.
Amazing.
But I got to tell you, the more I think about it, the movie Idiocracy missed the mark, because we're living a much scarier and funnier version. Just my thoughts.
Yeah, we are in a weird world.
Yes, sir. But Bob, I appreciate the time as always. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick.
Our good friend Bob Ney. I got to tell you, you know, the if you haven't seen Idiocracy, and I don't promote very much, at least the first 5 minutes, you got to watch at least that. And then you know kind of where we are. Quick break, right back.
Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. In the early 1980s, telephone service in the United States went through a major shakeup. Up until that time, AT&T, through their Bell operating companies, monopolized almost all of the telephone service in the nation. 150 million phones were part of the Bell network. A federal antitrust lawsuit had wound its way through the courts and was reaching a conclusion. Ma Bell saw the handwriting on the wall that they would lose the suit and move to reach a settlement to break the company up. Into that restructuring chaos, the workers at Bell sat down to negotiate a new contract. And on this day in labor history, the year was 1983. 675,000 workers walked off the job. It was one of the largest strikes in United States history. The strikers were members of the Communication Workers of America, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and the Telecommunications International Union. They wanted improved wages, more funding for health care, and improved employee training. The strike lasted for 22 days. Scabs and managers attempt to keep the system going, but those who called in for information often had long wait times. Finally, management agreed to meet the union's demands. It was the last time the CWA sat across the negotiating table from Ma Bell. The company's breakup occurred just a few months later. With the breakup came a slow eroding of the number of unionized employees. 55% of the Bell employees belonged to unions in 1983. Just 15 years later, that number had fallen by half to 27%. The changing technology of cell phones, overseas outsourcing, and the emergence of new companies have made this workforce an important front for today's labor movement. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. Evidently, Rudy's in some financial troubles. Turns out he's going to be putting up his New York apartment up for sale. Listed the Upper East Side, a little place where he lives, $6.5 million. Now the report is not sure why Rudy's selling. I guess he's owned it for several decades. But, you know, I'm thinking legal fees are chewing up a lot of his disposable income. You can only get so much money from the Mujahideen cult and from all kind of other, you know, questionable groups. If you're going to be friends with Trump, you're probably going to need a lawyer at some point, because clearly he's not going to, going to pony up anything. Now, what's interesting, we were talking about polling a second ago, and New York YouGov CBS News poll shows that 59% of Americans think that what's going on with Trump is about stopping him from seeking re-election. I don't see that at all, because, you know, I think most Democrats, at least most that I know, they want Trump. They want to be able to beat Trump because, you know, he's not getting new voters. I don't see him generating new votes. I see him only losing votes, especially as more comes out about the things that he's done and the things that he says. This is a great narrative. It's about him. I don't think it is. I think it's about the reality. He caused this on himself. As I said earlier, the documents case would have never been brought against any president unless they did exactly what Trump did. When the records folks come and say, hey, we'd like our stuff back, please. And then the enforcement arm comes and said, hey, you got that stuff? And you lie about it and you have people move it around and you hide it and you brag about having it. You put them in a position where they have no choice. All of this has been about having no choice. Trump gave no one an off-road.